funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
It's uncommon these days for high-functioning people to admit to eating junk food or failing to get enough exercise. Such choices are frowned upon in a culture that values personal responsibility for one's health. So why do so many successful professionals blithely confess to, or let's face it, boast about, getting by on very little sleep? This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. While success in other times and places may have meant leisure time, our hard-driven culture equates a packed calendar with being very important. The casualty? Sleep. A few years ago, Arianna Huffington was among those who sacrificed sleep for career. She was traveling, raising her daughters, and working, as she still does, as co-founder, president, and editor-in-chief of the Huffington Post Media Group. But when she fainted in her office from lack of rest, shattering her cheekbone and coming to in a pool of blood, she had a wake-up call. Her new book is called The Sleep Revolution, Transforming Your Life One Night at a Time. Arianna, welcome back to Think.
Thank you so much. Great to be with you again.
You write that you were raised in a family that revered sleep. How was it made clear to you as a girl that sleep mattered?
So, you know, we lived with my mother and my younger sister. My parents were separated in a one-bedroom apartment in Athens, Greece. And it was pretty crowded quarters. But my mother made it very clear that, let's say, if I was going to study while my sister was asleep, I had to do it in the kitchen. I had to be very careful not to turn on the light when I got into bed. And she kept literally telling us what modern science would completely endorse. She would say, when you get enough sleep, everything will be better. Your grades will be better, your mood will be better, and you'll be healthier. So in a sense, everything my mother, who didn't have a college education, said then has now been completely proven by the relatively young science of sleep.
It's funny because a lot of parents do try to ensure that their children get adequate sleep. We're not necessarily so good at modeling sleep habits for them.
Exactly. And that's a big problem. In the same way, and the two things are connected, that we talk to our children and our teenagers about getting off their phones while we surreptitiously check texts, you know, under the dinner table. So I think unquestionably our children and millennials are modeling our generation's practices around sleep, and they date back to the first Industrial Revolution. I was very interested to try and understand while I was doing research for my book, how come that we started devaluing sleep, which, of course, ancient cultures revered. Whether you look at ancient Egypt, ancient Greece, Rome, sleep was a way to connect with the sacred, to receive valuable insights about health, about leadership, about decisions. And then suddenly, with the first Industrial Revolution, we started thinking that we can treat human beings like machines and minimize downtime. And on top of it, we had cultural icons like Thomas Edison, who got it completely wrong about sleep. And he would say things like, sleep is an absurdity, it's going to be eliminated in the future. And a lot of people who wanted to be great listened and followed the advice of people who may have been great in other areas but got it wrong on sleep.
And of course, Edison and his team gave us the light bulb and allowed us to drive away the night in a way that had never been possible for any other generation.
Absolutely. But that's why it requires more discipline, which became even harder after the digital revolution, to set boundaries and to create what I call in the book a clear demarcation line between our day life, our projects, our incompletions, and our sleep, the time to recharge and to wake up refreshed, to approach the day not the way I approached many days for many years in my life, you know, kind of sleepwalking through my life, checking the boxes, going from meeting to meeting, but actually fully present, vital, and with a sense of joy.
there were times, I mean, it didn't happen all the time, but you were in a meeting and sort of realized you'd been asleep without realizing it. Asleep with your eyes open.
Yes, exactly. And what makes it worse is that very often we go into meetings with our devices, supposedly to take notes, but very often you see people just answering texts or emails or updating their Facebook profiles. And we at the Huffington Post, for example, have banned devices at meetings. And we ask people to use one of our beautiful notebooks to take notes. And it has really made a big difference. People are more present. They are 100% there. And the meetings are shorter.
Ariana, sleep feels like downtime, but there is business that our brains can only accomplish when we're not awake. Can you tell us a little bit about what happens within our brains to our memories and the things we've learned over the course of the day while we're asleep?
Well, that is what is so interesting. We used to think that sleep is a time of inactivity. In fact, one metaphor was it's a time when we put the car in the garage and turn the ignition key off. But in fact, sleep is a time of frenetic activity. That's the time when all the toxins that have accumulated during the day are washed away. And if that doesn't happen, it's really dangerous. It's dangerous for the consolidation of memories, and it ultimately can lead to Alzheimer's. And what is so interesting is that the brain has these two functions. Either it's awake and alert or asleep and cleaning up. And it can't do both functions at the same time. Dr. Nedergaard, who came up with this study, actually has this interesting metaphor. She says you can either entertain the guests or clean up the house. You can't do both at once.
When we are sleeping, a lot of people are aware that there are different sort of phases within the cycles of sleep. What's happening, say, during REM sleep?
So, you know, there are four cycles of sleep. And again, another great metaphor. I don't know why, but a lot of sleep scientists talk in metaphors. So they've got dreams. Yeah, Dr. Ronneberg, who is one of the leading sleep scientists in Germany, talks about how if you don't complete all four cycles, REM, rapid eye movement being the deepest, you actually, he says, end up with the equivalent result of pulling your laundry out of the laundry machine before all the cycles are completed, which, as he says, is ending up with wet and dirty laundry. And I love that because that's how I feel when I wake up before I've had a full night's sleep, before I've completed all these cycles. And that's really why it's such a bad habit to wake up with an alarm. Because just think of it, the word alarm, it means that our body is immediately flooded with a fight or flight response, with the stress hormone, cortisol, and adrenaline before anything has even happened.
So your plan is to try to get enough sleep, and you set an alarm for a couple of minutes after you absolutely have to be up just to be sure that you're awake, but you usually don't need it anymore.
Yes, I'm now happy to say that it's very rare that I wake up with an alarm. Again, I set it up because it's safety, and then I don't have to think about it. But I always wake up, well, with a few exceptions, before my alarm. And it's just a great feeling. And the difference is enormous. I think what has happened to me, and, you know, I'm a late convert, so I'm not saying any of that with any sense of superiority. I mean, I got it late. I got it right late in life. But the difference is so enormous. I mean, I now cannot stand myself when I'm sleep deprived. I don't like the person I become. Irritable, moody, reactive. And that's why it's become easier to prioritize sleep. It's because the way I feel when I've had enough sleep is like a magnet that draws me there. And I feel particularly excited about bringing the message to colleges. We did a college outreach to over 300 colleges where we actually brought sleep fairs or books and other products that can help people improve their understanding of sleep and therefore their lives.
College students are known for sleeping a lot, but what they do, I guess, is make up for lack of sleep because they stay up all night and then they sleep all the next afternoon, that sort of thing. Is that the problem?
Well, no, the main problem is that they really don't get the sleep they need. I mean, there is a saying that practically every college has a version of, which is grades, social life, sleep, pick two. And I think, and unfortunately, sleep is not one of the three they pick. Hmm. And yet all the modern science makes it clear that when you pick sleep, the other two are much better. You know, you're much more present and joyful for your social life, and you do much better in terms of work and your grades.
The one thing you and I didn't have when we were in college that would interrupt our sleep, we may have had grades and we may have had social lives, but we didn't have technology. We didn't have these blue lights flashing in our faces as we ostensibly were trying to get to sleep. Can you talk about why our handheld devices are such a barrier to good sleep?
So they're a huge barrier. In fact, of all the best practices and tips and techniques that I have in the second part of the book, I would say the most important is creating a transition to sleep. And the first step of the transition is turning off our devices before we turn off the light, ideally at least 10 minutes. I do it 30 minutes before, and charge them outside the bedroom. So you create a kind of screen-free zone, a clear demarcation between your day with all its problems and to-do lists, and then your night, the time to recharge. Hmm.
Can you, I mean, have you been able to put your finger on why, as a society, we don't give the kind of respect to the health benefits of sleep that we give to exercise and healthful eating?
You know, I think we need to recognize that cultures often believe false things. I was amazed to recognize that there were ads for cigarettes in the 1960s, including by doctors who would say things like, "I smoke menthols because they refresh my throat." Now, the science on the dangers of smoking was already clear, but it took a while for the perception to catch up with the science. And I think sleep deprivation is the new smoking. We're at a similar moment of transition where a lot of leaders and a lot of parts of society, from the hotel industry to the airline industry to colleges, are recognizing the importance. But we have the early adopters and others who are still sticking to the Neanderthal belief that working, quote-unquote, 24/7 makes you productive.
We're speaking this hour with Arianna Huffington, co-founder, president, and editor-in-chief of the Huffington Post Media Group. Her new book is called The Sleep Revolution, Transforming Your Life One Night at a Time. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Arianna Huffington, who is co-founder, president, and editor-in-chief of the Huffington Post Media Group and author of the new book, The Sleep Revolution, Transforming Your Life One Night at a Time. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. Arianna, we were talking before the break about high-functioning, very successful people and their lack of sleep occasionally. What do you know about what presidential candidates do about sleep? I look at them, you know, crisscrossing all over the country and making speeches and staying up late for dinners and getting up early for breakfast. I really don't know how it's possible for a human being to sustain that pace.
Well, clearly, we see all the bad decisions made as a result. We see the outbursts, the tweets that they have to retract, et cetera, et cetera. What is interesting is that despite all that, despite all the science linking bad decision-making with sleep deprivation, they brag about how little sleep they get. They still consider it a badge of honor. Donald Trump famously brags about only sleeping 4 to 4.5 hours and sleeping with his phone and tweeting in the middle of the night or retweeting Mussolini. Ted Cruz sent a fundraising letter 10 days before he suspended his campaign, talking about how he had sacrificed sleep and health for the country, as though we want our leaders to be exhausted and sick. It's just like the minute you really spend any time with the science of sleep and the clear impact that sleep deprivation has on leadership and decision-making, these kind of statements become really absurd. And another very clear indication of what happens when we're sleep-deprived is looking at the Marco Rubio's performance in the New Hampshire election that completely, in New Hampshire's, debate, that completely derailed his campaign. As was discussed after the event, he was exhausted. And if you compare that performance, when he couldn't retrieve information he clearly had, with his performance in the following debate, it was as though he was a different human being. He had not just suddenly gotten 50% smarter. He just was able to retrieve what he already knew. So we have endless examples like that, including cases where there were health consequences, like Hillary Clinton collapsing and hitting her head and getting a concussion while she was Secretary of State after a grueling schedule. There was actually an interview she gave where she talked about she would be at these meetings with foreign leaders and sometimes she would have to dig her fingers into her palm to stay awake. So this cannot be something we admire as a feat of endurance, because there's no way, no matter how brilliant you are, that you can do the best job for your country under these circumstances.
When you heard the news of her collapse when she was Secretary of State, you had already had your collapse. Did you think to yourself before there was any medical information given, this is probably what happened?
Oh, of course. You know, I mean, it takes many forms. You know, they said it was dehydration. But, you know, all these things happen when our immune systems are weakened, our whole nervous system is weakened, all the biometrics are compromised, and that's when things happen. Otherwise, we all know that we are surrounded by viruses. We are surrounded by things that can adversely affect our health. But if our inner environment, if our immune system, if our inflammatory markers are in good shape, we don't have adverse effects.
I've been interested in the sleep, the health benefits of sleep for a long time. I didn't know until I read your book that there has been some research that links poor quality sleep and other sleep disturbances with aggressive tumor growth. Can sleep protect us from cancer, or is that going too far?
Well, yes, like everything. It's not an absolute causality, but now sleep deprivation has been linked to cancer, to hypertension and heart disease, to Alzheimer's, to obesity and diabetes, because when we are sleep deprived, we crave the very things that put on weight, like carbs and sugars. So, yes, it does affect every aspect of our health profoundly. And incidentally, so does chronic dependence on sleeping pills. So when we turn to sleeping pills as a quick fix, we are also dramatically damaging our health. And that's why it's important to look at all the natural alternatives. And I've tried to cover everything in the second part of the book, you know, from the simplest steps we can take, like a hot bath or a shower to wash out the day, lowering the lights, darkening the room, lowering the temperature, all these basic, simple things, all the way to cognitive behavioral therapy if you need to deal with more chronic insomnia. But there are so many natural alternatives. We just need to change our minds about sleep's importance, and then we will justify spending the time to try different things and see what works for us.
All right, let's go to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Garrett on the line in Goldthwaite. Hi, Garrett.
Hey, Chris. How are you doing?
Very well, thanks.
Yes, my question was, how does going to bed under the influence of, let's say, alcohol affect the sleep cycles and affect your quality of sleep?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you. Would you mind repeating it?
He was wondering about if you go to sleep and you've been drinking alcohol, what happens to the quality of your sleep?
Oh, so that's interesting. You know, the myth of the nightcap. You know, if you have a glass of wine with dinner, and there's an interval between dinner and when you go to sleep, it's not a problem. It's when you have a nightcap, which sometimes people do just before you go to sleep because you think that will relax you. It may just relax you, but halfway through the night, it changes allegiances and it wakes you up. And you're often dehydrated, and it makes it harder to go to sleep. So if you want something soothing just before you go to sleep, try different herbal teas like licorice tea or lavender tea or chamomile tea, something warm and soothing before you turn off the light.
Many people are aware that sleep problems are linked to mental illnesses, including depression. Could it be that sleep problems trigger depression rather than the other way around?
Oh, I think absolutely sleep problems trigger depression. There is such a clear connection now between being exhausted and becoming anxious and depressed in colleges. They have also found, as they checked into the mental health problems that are growing, that when you scratch the surface, there is often sleep deprivation at the bottom. You see it with new mothers going through a postpartum depression because they're sleep deprived. Yeah, there is a very direct connection between the two. And we see it anecdotally in ourselves. You know, I know from myself that when I'm sleep deprived, the world looks darker.
Right.
You know, the same problem that I can deal with very easily and take in my stride when I've had a full night's sleep becomes mountainous and seems much harder to deal with.
It is funny, even, you know, when you are lying awake in the middle of the night worrying about a problem, once you finally drift off, when you get up in the morning, it never seems quite as bad as it did when you were lying there sleep deprived.
Yes, absolutely. It's kind of amazing to remember how different we feel after a good night's sleep. I think it puts everything in perspective.
Yeah.
And connects us with our wisdom. You know, we talk a lot, and God knows I've talked a lot in the book and on book two about the connection between sleep and performance. You know, sleep as a performance enhancement. But also sleep is incredibly important in terms of what matters in life, in terms of what to prioritize, in terms of the recognition that we are not just our successes and our failures, we are not just our to-do lists and our projects. It's really, as it has always been seen, a gateway to the mystery of life and the sacred, even if we don't Even if we don't believe that there is more to this life, we still can experience that mystery.
It should come as no surprise that athletes, elite athletes, understand the value of sleep. And these are people who tend to be very protective of their sleep hygiene.
Yes, absolutely. Because, again, they have learned the impact it has on the court and in the field. And that's making a huge difference for those athletes who track their stats. So they have like a very clear way to demonstrate the performance enhancement that sleep is.
All right, let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Dawn on the line in Burleson. Hi, Dawn.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Okay, my question is the opposite. What about people? I'm from a family of sleepers. We sleep 7 to 9 hours a night, and then sometimes we like to take naps. And a power nap for us is 3 hours minimum. If we try to do a power nap of 20 minutes, that's like being completely sleep deprived for us. And I was wondering, are there any bad things about people who love to sleep?
Well, actually, scientists tell us that you can overeat, but you cannot oversleep. So when you have a three-hour nap, is it after a full night's sleep, or is it normally after a night when you've been more sleep-deprived?
Your full night's sleep.
You get a full night's sleep, and then you need a three-hour nap?
To nap. Literally love to nap.
So it's just children, recreational, is that it?
Yeah, it's like the children love to nap, the adults love to nap. This is just part of something that's in my family that I've noticed that it's not in other families.
And then do you feel good about it? Do you feel recharged and happy about your life? How do you feel?
Completely. Very happy.
Yeah. Great. I mean, listen, people spend an enormous amount of money in therapy trying to get what you are getting with sleep. I think this is an amazingly wise family. You found a way to, as actually Chris said, both to sleep to recharge, but also to sleep because you love it. In a sense, I talk about that in the book, which is kind of you have rekindled the romance with sleep. A lot of people consider sleep like a heavily mined border that they don't want to cross, or they want to delay crossing, you know, as long as possible. But you're embracing it. And I would love you to write about it on the Huffington Post.
All right, you'll have to think about that, Dawn. So I want to ask you this, Arianna, because sometimes there may be people listening saying, yes, I know sleep is great, if only it did not elude me whenever I want it. You know, people struggle with insomnia, sometimes for something as simple and yet monumental as a problem that is keeping them awake. And we've all had these nights. What have you learned about setting aside the concerns of the day so that you can get a good night's sleep and then get up in the morning energized to do something about them?
Well, the key again, especially if we're anxious and dealing with a problem that seems very stubborn, the key is that transition to sleep. That's when it makes even more difference to power down your phones at least half an hour before you're going to turn off the lights, to have a hot bath that maybe you prolong, or a hot shower, to get in your night dress or PJs or T-shirt that you don't wear during the day to go to the gym, and to maybe read something that is completely disconnected from your problems and from work, like poetry or philosophy or a novel, before you turn off the light. I think doing all that will definitely set you up to be less likely to have trouble falling asleep. And if you still have trouble falling asleep, I have an appendix of 12 meditations that you can play even if you are not a meditator that will help you go to sleep. And what is wonderful is that I can promise you that you are going to find at least one that really resonates with you. I have found two, for example, that I've never her to the end, which I often play if I'm on a plane and I want to go to sleep, or if I wake up in the middle of the night and I'm not going back to sleep right away.
Dawn talked about loving her three-hour naps, which some people might love to have, but a lot of people don't have that much time. Is there an ideal length for a quick nap throughout the day? Is, you know, an hour too long? Is it just right? How long should we be napping if we need
to nap? The average length is about 20 minutes. I mean, we have two nap rooms at the Huffington Post, and people normally just have a 20-minute nap. And normally, you only need a nap if you haven't gotten enough sleep the night before. You know, I mean, you may enjoy a nap as our previous caller did, but in terms of needing a nap to be fully recharged, that's if you are jet-lagged or sleep-deprived for whatever reason. And that, for me, is the best way to reset the day is a nap, instead of, you know, a fifth cinnamon bun or a sixth cup of coffee or whatever it is that we normally tend to go to. You know, leaders throughout history have used them. You know, Churchill famously talked about power napping, and it helped him win the Second World War, so nothing bad with that.
In terms of napping at the Huffington Post, how did you convince your employees that it was actually okay? You know, sometimes companies put in these beautiful, they put in game tables, or they put in nap rooms, and it's almost like they're just for display.
Well, we have really done so much work around sleep. Ever since my own collapse, you know, we launched a dedicated section on sleep in 2007. So there's a lot of conversation in the newsroom about it.
My guest is Arianna Huffington, co-founder, president, and editor-in-chief of the Huffington Post Media Group and author of the new book, The Sleep Revolution, Transforming Your Life One Night at a Time. We will continue the conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join it by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Arianna Huffington about her new book, The Sleep Revolution, Transforming Your Life One Night at a Time. Arianna, I want to go back to what you mentioned earlier about the sort of seductive dangers of sleep medications. They are, on occasion, prescribed for people with medical needs. Your concern is that it's really easy for them to become habit-forming and, when they are, to cause some long-term damage.
Yes, and, you know, again, there is a lot of science around that, about the times when they become, when people become dependent on them, especially because they have diminishing returns, like any drug. And one of the problems, Chris, is that in the States, we allow television advertising of sleeping pills. We are only one of two countries, New Zealand being the other one, that allows that. And so we have all these pictures of happy people frolicking in fields.
Butterflies,
while a cheerful voice recites a long list of terrifying side effects, including, you know, you may get in a car without having any knowledge of it and drive. I mean, That has happened, of course, with tragic consequences. So it just shows really two things for me. One, that we don't recognize the importance of sleep enough to take the time to look at natural alternatives, which exist and have existed throughout history. And so we take the easy solution, which is to pop a pill.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Hashim on the line in Garland. Hi, Hashim.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Can you hear me?
Yes.
So I'm actually a physician, and I just want to see if Arianna knew about this. Some time ago, somebody suggested to me a podcast. It's called Sleep With Me. And it's just a guy who tells these very weird, like, bedtime stories, which is completely disjointed, changing subjects within a statement in a dreamy voice. And I've never been able to go past 5 minutes of listening to it without falling asleep. And several of my patients have tried it, and it's helped them as well. And I was wondering if she knew about this and what her thoughts on that were.
Thanks for your call.
I don't know about this, but I would love to find out about it. I'll check it out. And if you want to write about it, would love to have you write about it. That's actually a great example of how somebody has found some that really works for them and resonates with them. And maybe it will resonate with you or me, and maybe it will not. But that's the exciting journey of becoming kind of your own sleep scientist and seeing what is it that does it for you.
I've heard from people who use public radio podcasts to fall asleep, and I don't know what that says about our content, but I think maybe sometimes having a voice that is not, you know, yelling and not a lot of loud noises can be helpful for folks trying to fall asleep.
Yes. The only thing I would do is not do it on a new show. Because I think there's something about the news that, you know, includes planes coming down and Donald Trump talking. And I don't think it's the best thing to hear, even subconsciously, if you have fallen asleep. But a soothing voice like yours, Chris, having a conversation about sleep would be probably a soothing way to go to sleep. Although I must say, my strong preference is reading a physical book.
Mm-hmm.
I love the fact that there are no screens, no smartphone. Definitely I would recommend, if anybody's listening to something, to download it on an iPod. Because if you have your smartphone by your bed, and you wake up for whatever reason and can't fall asleep right away, you are going to be tempted to check your texts and emails and notifications, and that will make it much, much harder to go back to sleep.
You write down your dreams if you happen to awaken at night. What are you looking for the next morning?
So I write down my dreams either if I wake up in the middle of the night with a vivid dream or in the morning. And I don't do it religiously, but I do it as often as I can. Because two things. One is it almost sends a message to your subconscious that you value your dreams, and it makes it much easier to remember them. And also there are often insights in them. Sometimes you're just processing something that's remained unresolved in the day. Sometimes there is an insight about a project, a person, the future. And sometimes they don't mean anything, but I write them down anyway. And it's kind of adds a dimension to my sleep, because now it's almost like looking forward to what's going to be in the Cineplex.
The New York Times did a great piece about you going to sleep after you had this conversion. And it sounds like you just create this idyllic environment for yourself. And I believe that everything in the article is true, but I know that you travel a lot. So what do you do when you're away from home and you're not as in control of your environment as you would be at your house?
Well, that is absolutely true. So what I do is I have a little sleep kit that I have permanently packed in my overnight bag, and it includes a very soft silk eye mask, lavender spray, noise cancelling headphones, and all my favorite soothing teas like licorice and lavender, and also it includes black tape that I put over all these blinking lights in hotel rooms.
Oh.
I don't know if you've noticed that there are more and more and more of them. And I actually make a point of always asking for a quiet room and always asking for a room that is as dark as possible, if they have blackout curtains. And if they, sometimes have you noticed how the light comes through the door?
Yeah.
If you can see the door to the hallway from your bed, I put a towel in front of it. You know, taking like 5 minutes to sleep-proof your room, it's totally worth it in terms of sleeping in an environment which is obviously not set for you. And I definitely, the other thing I do is, you know, when if you ask for a wake-up call, they always ask you if you want a follow-up. And I'm like a passionate opponent of the snooze button or anything that basically means that you're going to hear your alarm or the hotel operator more than once, which I don't understand. I don't understand why people think that's good, you know, to kind of prolong the torture.
Yeah, I guess there are differing ideas about the snooze button. There are people who feel like that makes waking up easier. Seems to me that once you're up, you might as well just get up.
Exactly. Once you're up, you're up. And I think it's better to set your alarm for the last possible moment you have to get up than to kind of pretend that you can go back to sleep for 5 minutes.
I love the idea, by the way, of Arianna Huffington like standing on the desk, you know, putting duct tape over the blinking light on the smoke detector or whatever it is. Do you take it down as you're leaving?
Oh my God, that's a very good point. I fear I don't, but maybe it kind of educates others.
All right, let's go back to the phones now. We have Jared on the line in Boyd. Hi, Jared.
Hi.
Hi. Go right ahead.
My question. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, my question is, I tend to watch the same movie or the same genre movie every night and to go to bed. I feel like if I don't do that, I sit there and twiddle my thumbs and I just can't go to sleep. But as long as I put on like a kind of fantasy movie or something that just takes my mind off the day, I tend to go to bed, especially if it's the same movie over, within like 5 minutes. Is that good or bad?
So what, like, could you tell me what kind of movie?
It's usually like a fantasy movie, like a Lord of the Rings or Harry Potter, just something I don't even have to think about. It's just something to set the mind in a different mood, and just, I tend to pass right out.
And then does it does the screen stay on? Does it wake you up later?
No, I don't know if it's just habit or what, but I just zone it out. I just fall right asleep and get a great night's sleep.
And, well, you know, if that works for you and you are not, if you have a partner who can't sleep with a TV on, that might be a problem. But if, at least for the moment, you are sleeping alone that works for you, I don't think there is really, there are always exceptions. I mean, in general, the recommendation is not to watch screens or read on screens before you go to sleep, but you are doing something that works for you. You are being transported in another world, and then it appears that the movie comes to an end. And unlike if you have the TV on, which doesn't come to an end, it's not likely to wake you up because it comes to an end and stops. So, I mean, you, as the British say, you have the proof of the pudding is in the eating. It's one of my favorite English expressions. And if it works for you, do it. I think that's, as we said earlier, you need to become your own spiritual sleep scientist and experiment.
What about people who intend to sleep each night with a partner, another person, and their habits are very different? This can be couples feel terrible about each other or about their relationship if they're not able to physically sleep together in the same room.
Okay, and that's a complete delusion, incidentally. And maybe because I'm Greek, I'm not a big believer in this. It's more of an American habit because in Europe, a lot of people don't feel that if your partner snores or kicks you or likes to sleep with the TV on and you don't, it doesn't mean anything in terms of your marriage or your relationship. It doesn't say anything about whether you love each other, or whether you are or are not having sex. If you occasionally sleep in a separate bedroom, I think that's just a kind of romantic delusion. And I can't tell you, on my book too, it's one of the topics people bring up the most. It's like people are often like entirely sleep deprived. They begin to really resent their partner, and yet they kind of cling to the idea that they have to sleep together no matter what. And I think we need to have a whole section in the book about that, because we need to give each other permission to do what allows us to get a fully restorative night's sleep and wake up loving our partner and not resenting them. I mean, I had a great story with a host of a podcast I was doing who was also a triathlete, and he said to me, you know, I like the temperature at 60 degrees. My wife cannot sleep if it's below 70 degrees. We would keep it at 70 degrees. He said, I really began to so resent her that our sex life kind of disappeared, and we didn't have a second bedroom. So he said, I ended up putting a tent on the terrace. And now he said, it's the best thing I've done for our marriage. So the important thing is to give ourselves permission to really to get a full good night's sleep, whatever it takes.
All right, Arianna, the last thing I want to ask you is this. You had this sort of conversion after 2007, and you've realized the importance of sleep. You feel like it gives you better health. You've got a boatload of research. But you have to give some things up, right, to get as much sleep as you get today. What are you able to say no to now that maybe 15 years ago you would have felt obligated to do?
Well, actually, what is interesting is that we have a lot more discretionary time than we think. Somebody is watching House of Cards. I have only seen one episode. There is also discretionary time in terms of going out. Like if I'm on book tour, for example, I'm often in a city where I have friends. I'd like to have dinner with them. But if I have a morning TV show, I'm not going to. And that is not, I'm not saying that with any sense of I'm sacrificing something, because frankly, as I said earlier, waking up before I'm fully rested sets me up for such a bad day where I don't really have the same vitality and joy in what I'm doing, that frankly, it's just not worth it.
All right. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, so kind of, that becomes like a magnet that draws you to make certain choices.
Arianna Huffington is co-founder, president, and editor-in-chief of the Huffington Post Media Group. Her new book is The Sleep Revolution, Transforming Your Life One Night at a Time. Arianna, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much for making time for us.
Thank you so much.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Samantha Guzman is associate producer, and Jeff Whittington is executive producer. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. The show's email address, think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.